I listened with great interest this morning to some wonderful philosophical ideas, and I must confess that I'm not a religious philosopher, and far from it. I'm just a humble judicial technician, and I'm going to have to limit my remarks into that particular area. We've been asked to talk about regional perspectives, that is, what is happening in our region on the emerging challenges of religious freedom. And necessarily, I'll be focusing upon the United States of America. Almost all questions, sooner or later, get into the courts in our country. And so we have our heritage as one of judiciaries trying to deal with these issues. A little background will help you on how we function within our court. The founders had a very important view about religion, and it's contained in the First Amendment to the Constitution, which states that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, comma, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The founders were most concerned that there not be a national religion. And so they put into the Constitution that the United States Congress could not have a national religion, one that would be supported and have a monopoly. With that done, they then set up what is called the Free Exercise Clause, because they wanted to make sure Congress did not prohibit the free exercise of religion. Their thought was, Without a monopoly religion, the various religions would compete with each other, and as a result, each would have freedom. So in effect, the founders believed that the Free Exercise Clause was the most important. And it's that Free Exercise Clause that I'm going to talk about now. In our court system in the United States, perhaps in other countries, the courts decide and may decide based upon how they review. That is, what is the standard they're going to look at the particular statute? And based upon that standard, the determination of the question may be determined. And so it was with our way we looked at our task. Until 18 years ago, our law has required the government to justify any substantial burden on religiously motivated conduct by testing and identifying a compelling government interest and by requiring the means used to be narrowly tailored to achieve that interest. This is often referred to as the strict scrutiny test or the compelling government interest test. Other tests were determined by rational relationship. That is there a rational relationship between what the government wants to do and the particular interest? The strict scrutiny test required much more. There must be a compelling government interest, and what is done must be narrowly tailored to achieve that interest. Up until 18 years ago, we were guided by that particular test, strict scrutiny, when we're dealing with the free exercise clause. You can see if you lower the requiring showing by the government to validate their interference with religious conduct, it would automatically allow the government greater latitude in restricting conduct which is motivated by religion. That's exactly what happened in 1990 when the Supreme Court of the United States decided a very important case, Employment Division versus Smith, by a 5-4 opinion. The majority written by Justice Scalia and the dissent by Justice O'Connor. These people were not irreligious. Justice Scalia is a very active Catholic. He has a son who's a full-time priest. Justice O'Connor is of the Protestant faith. She's an Episcopalian. Both of them go to church every Sunday. And yet they saw this issue differently, and so it wasn't based upon their religious background. What was the case about? Smith and Black were fired from their jobs with a private drug rehabilitation organization because they ingested peyote for sacramental purposes at a ceremony of the Native Christian Church. That is, our ancestors over here before we came have their own church. Peyote is not like marijuana, but it's pretty close. And so it's on the list of things that you cannot ingest. The question was whether the state of Oregon could deny unemployment insurance benefits, and that was based upon whether the persons could be charged with a criminal act of ingesting peyote. The majority made a distinction between a belief and an act pursuant to the belief. So we're talking conduct. Not just the belief, which is still protected the same it was before, but what about conduct of a person that was taken pursuant to that belief? While the belief would be protected by requiring the higher test of strict scrutiny, the act could be regulated by criminal laws that are valid and neutral. Valid and neutral. The majority relied upon Reynolds, which had approved the applying of an anti-polygamy criminal statute to those practicing the act of polygamy as part of their religious Based upon this, the court in Smith rejected the test which had been required of governmental actions and the substantial burden of a religious practice be justified by compelling government interest. So if an act, even though motivated by a religious belief which was protected, that act could be charged by a criminal act passed by the Congress, which was neutral to all people. The Smith dissent contends that because the First Amendment does not distinguish between religious beliefs and conduct motivated by sincere religious beliefs, then like belief itself, such conduct must be presumptively protected by the Free Exercise Clause. So the government in Smith should have been required to justify any substantial burden on religiously motivated conduct by compelling state interest and by using means narrowly tailored to achieve that interest. Thus, Smith still required a compelling government need to restrict belief, but does not require this strict scrutiny test when dealing with conduct motivated by sincerely held religious beliefs, if the issue at hand is the application of criminal laws which are valid and neutral. This was a great change in the United States of America. So what was the response to Smith? State and federal legislators responded to Smith to limit or abrogate its effect on the Free Exercise Clause. The first statute was passed by the United States Congress in 1993, called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Subsequently, the United States Supreme Court held that as far as the act is concerns states, it was abrogated. So the statute still stood for the federal government, but not for our 50 states. 13 states have since adopted their own Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Congress then adopted two additional statutes to strengthen the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. One of these standards deals with religious land and has already been approved by my court in the case of Guru versus County of Sutter. This in 2006. The specific question before our court was whether zoning land as agriculture created a substantial burden resulting in the denial of a permit to build a church, in this instance, a Sikh temple. We held the government did not prove the compelling interest for its action. We also held the action question
was a permissible exercise of Congress's power under the Constitution. With substantial opposition from the legislature and courts, it may be that the high protections for freedom of religion has been restored. But we do not know as yet, because the Supreme Court has not taken a case on the Smith issue since it was filed in 1990. This indicates how courts in the United States sometimes can change what the United States Supreme Court has held, even when it is determined they are determining a constitutional question, because the nature of the test can very often determine the outcome of the case. There's been significant state constitutional change since then. In our country, we have what we call our federalism. And the founders thought that only a limited amount of government of power would go to the central government, and each one of the states, now numbering 50, would have the majority of the power. So in the United States, sometimes the state constitution can rule, even though the federal constitution might be different. I'm indebted to the work of Cole Durham and Robert Smith for their view of what's happened in the states since that time. And I'll conclude my remarks with this, because it demonstrates how, at least in my country, the final word is not necessarily with the Supreme Court. If the people feel strongly about religious freedoms, very often there's a way to circumvent the United States Supreme Court, circumvent in the nice consideration of it, because it's all valid under the Constitution. Only 8 Supreme Courts have shown any inclination to accept Smith, while in contrast, 11 states have interpreted their state constitution free exercise clause to require strict scrutiny analysis for conduct motivated by sincerely held beliefs. 18 other states have not yet made the decision. However, in many of those states, the courts employed a strict scrutiny test even before Smith. Thus, where we do not know where we stand today on a compelling government interest, whether it must be proven to restrict acts by the statutes of the government, we do know that there are changes coming. Only a handful of states have expressed a desire to follow Smith, and of those, some have done so only in cases in which there was no state free exercise claims, or whether there was an exception which is allowed by Smith. In contrast, a total of 24 states have expressly rejected Smith and retained strict scrutiny, 13 of the states or by constitutional amendment and 11 by judicial enactment. Pre-Smith precedents in many of those states will probably be adopted. What this means is no more than 11%, that is 32 million of U.S. population, live in states that expressly follow Smith, whereas 58%, 173 million, live in the 24 states that have expressly rejected Smith. The remaining 31% live in states where strict scrutiny is at least potentially available as the high courts make up their mind. What does this mean? It means that even though the Supreme Court, in its wisdom, by a vote of 5-4, decided that strict scrutiny would no longer be used to challenge conduct motivated by sincere religious beliefs, that the Congress has been able to pass statutes, and the states have been able to pass statutes and have decisions which deal with this issue, which does not deal with the constitutional language. It deals with how we interpret the constitutional language. And because of that, it's considered now that all is well in the area of free agency. That is, the free agency to support which claim to religion you choose. And if the government decides to have statutes which will interfere with that conduct, they'll be required on by most all of the courts, and probably, if my crystal ball is clear, in the near future, be required by all courts to justify that action under strict scrutiny. Is there a compelling need? And is the means that's chosen properly tailored to affect only that means? Tune in next year, and I'll give you an update. Thank you.